Hi, I am Dan Dresner from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I also blog at danieldresner.com.
I'm Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post and author of The Confidant, Condoleezza Rice and the Creation of the Bush Legacy.
We're here to discuss that book. In the spirit of full disclosure, I should reveal my past dealings with Condi Rice. She was a professor at Stanford when I started the PhD program there in political science. I took a couple of courses from her. Also, later on in the 90s, in 1999, I was part of a group of what were called Young Turks that advised Condi during the 2000 campaign and helped a little bit with debate prep. I have not spoken with Condi since December 2001. She's been a little bit busy since then. And Glenn, you've covered her from the State Department beat, is that correct?
That's right. I've started covering the State Department beat for the Washington Post in May of 2002. So I covered her to some extent when she was National Security Advisor, but particularly as Secretary of State, I've traveled probably to 60 countries or so with her and spent many hours with her on the road. I also interviewed her for about 5 hours for my book. And I first met her in 1992 at the Republican Convention.
Very good. Before we sort of get into the questions about the book, why don't you start by sort of explaining why you who the book is for, why you wanted to write it, and what you think the big takeaway points are.
I decided to write the book because, of course, she's a very fascinating person who was Secretary of State in a very challenging and fascinating age. I aimed it both for foreign policy specialists, people who are potentially interested in foreign policy, because there's a lot of information in the book that hasn't been disclosed before, and I kind of take you inside the room as she's with foreign leaders or with the president or her staff and give you a kind of fly-on-the-wall insight on what it's like to conduct diplomacy at a very high level. But I also aimed it for general readers, people that don't know much about foreign policy, in an effort to, but who want to find out, what has gone on for the last 7 years and want to gain a better understanding of foreign policy issues. I focus in particular on 10 key challenges that Rice has had to deal with. And essentially what I write is that she's a smart, sophisticated diplomat, but her options and opportunities as Secretary of State are limited by mistakes she made when she was National Security Advisor. I argue, in fact, that she was one of the weakest National Security Advisors in U.S. history, and I kind of go back and forth and show how some of the choices she made as National Security Advisor, how that has affected the things that she has had to face as Secretary of State.
No, that's true. And I have to say, having read the book as well, I would recommend it. If nothing else, the anecdotes about some of the, particularly Rice's subordinates, are priceless. I think my favorite one you had was Phil Zelikow wanting to wear a sidearm on one of the trips to Baghdad. Another Rice aide, Jim Wilkinson, basically replying, "Sure, we'll give you a gun, but you get only one bullet." That sort of stuff, I thought it made it very interesting. To get to the larger point, which I agree with you, I mean, your point is that Condi's mistakes as NSC advisor have really hamstrung her ability to be a truly great Secretary of State. And, I think the larger, it's kind of tough to dispute the larger theme, although, as I was reading it, the thing that struck me was, beyond Brent Scowcroft, it's tough for me to think of a truly successful national security advisor, independent of the president. And even there, I mean, Scowcroft, succeeded largely because Bush was so engaged in, George H.W. Bush was largely engaged in foreign policy. So I guess one of the questions I would ask is, without trying to completely absolve Rice of mistakes that were made during her stint at NSC advisor, to what extent is the problems in the NSC advisor the fault of Rice, and to what extent really is this George W. Bush's fault for the kind of management style he oversaw, and to some extent his disengagement with foreign policy, for lack of a better word, with the details of foreign policy?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. I mean, and my book focuses on Condoleezza Rice, but you can't lose sight of the fact that this is the President Bush's administration. Mm-hmm. This is his White House and how he wants to run it. In particular, he has a very corporate management style where, you're kind of the vice president for peace if you're the Secretary of State, and you're the vice president for war if you're the defense secretary, and staff is staff. And that staff role Rice really gained power when she moved from National Security Advisor to Secretary of State. And he put her in a
which is unusual, because the normal conventional thoughts about this is that always it's proximity to the president that gives you power. I mean, that's how political scientists always think about it.
Right. Well, but, you know, there's proximity, there's personality, there's also the president's management style.
Yeah.
And I think that plays a key role. There's this priceless anecdote in one of the books on Paul O'Neill where he recounted how Bush ordered out Andrew Card out of an important meeting and told him, you know, your chief of staff rustled me up a cheeseburger.
Right, yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, Rice was remarkably, underqualified for the job of National Security Advisor. She had had one, so this gets to the point of, you know, beyond the what the president set up, but also Rice herself. She had one, mid-level role as a National Security Council staffer in the first Bush administration,
right.
Lasted all of 2 years. She was her expertise was the militaries of East Bloc countries. She's often with some Soviet expertise.
Her first book was on the Czechoslovak army. I actually have a copy of that book.
Yes, I've actually read it too.
Okay.
So, but it's a very narrow focus. I mean, we're not talking about someone like Kissinger or Brzezinski. Someone who had a whole history of writing about grand strategy.
That's true, although let me dispute you a little bit on this, because one could argue that Kissinger was actually equally inexperienced when he went into government. It's true that he had written a fair number of books about grand strategy, but if I remember correctly, when he became National Security Advisor, he didn't have any prior government experience. And similarly with Brzezinski, I don't think Brzezinski had any prior government experience either. So on that count, at least, Rice would have more experience. And while you're right that her expertise was on the Soviet military mostly during the 80s, she did have the 10 years after leaving the NSC position to actually sort of think, at least presumably, larger thoughts about world politics.
Right. So most of her writings had to do with Soviet expertise.
Yeah.
Again, it's a big question of the personality and the president's management style. I mean, as to whether or not someone becomes effective. I think the other thing that really hamstrung her, and this gets to the way this administration was set up, is you had a really incredibly large role for the vice president of foreign policy.
This is something, I noticed that I blog about this, in the first term, and correct me if I'm wrong, Cheney's role was truly unique if you compare it to that, to past vice presidents, particularly in the NSC process. And you had the sort of unprecedented situation of Cheney sitting in on principals meetings, and he is frankly the only elected official there. So I have to wonder if that was also, a serious constraint.
Right. Well, and there's this famous story where he tried to, early on in the administration, to make it so that he was the person running the NSC meetings.
Right.
And Rice actually went to the president and said, this is a bit much. But, Cheney backed off. But what you have is, the vice president with a very effective, very talented staff, having free range over all the foreign policy issues that interest him. And in the words of Richard Haass, who was the policy planning chief
right.
in the first term, that, he had three bites of the apple. If you didn't get the idea from state killed at the staff level, mm-hmm. then you could try to deal with it at the deputies level or the principals level. And then ultimately, he could do it just in a private conversation with the president.
Mm-hmm. There's no question that, Rice made an interesting choice. I don't know, you wonder if Bush forced her to do this, but in that, you're right. She didn't have the policy process. The policymaking process when she was at NSC was essentially broken down. And what's interesting is that some of her instincts were actually correct. I remember in early 2003, before the invasion, she gave an offhanded quote, or there was something reported in the New York Times Magazine where it made it very clear, for example, she didn't think much of Shalabi or any of the Iraqi exiles. And so it was startling to read that, and yet in the end see the prominent role that they played, post-occupation, which I think you're right suggested her weakness, and yet. I think she clearly made the decision that her job was to basically be the staff assistant to Bush and that her strength would presumably rely on that close relationship as opposed to being more of the honest broker a la Scowcroft.
Right, right. Well, and she was once quoted as saying that, her job was to translate the president's instincts into policy.
Mm-hmm.
which is very different from the idea of that you're going to bring to the table, you know, the State Department's view, the Defense Department's view, all a variety of different options. I had actually once taken a graduate course with Brzezinski after he was National Security Advisor for Carter, and, you know, he always required us to write options papers, which had four options.
Four? Wow. My students to write three. You know, I figure four is too many.
Well, his reasoning was very interesting, because he said if you had three, what you ended up was a very typical, you know, the one extreme version, then the other extreme version.
And then you get the Goldilocks, yeah.
And you're stuck with the one in the middle.
Yeah.
So if you did four, it forced you to actually come up with two slightly different variations in the middle, which gave the president more options. And you didn't really see that kind of dynamic necessarily playing out in this administration.
That's interesting. No, there's no question about that. Why don't we talk about, you know, the bulk of the book is obviously about Condi's role as Secretary of State. And one of the things you stressed at the beginning, and it's also come out, I think, in some of the press, some of the articles you've written for the Post since the book came out, is that she adopted a style of management at State that I think echoes Jim Baker's style when he was Secretary of State, which is Baker, when he came in, had a very small sort of coterie of top-ranking advisors. He didn't really deal with the Foreign Service officers. He didn't, you know, sort of manage Foggy Bottom. That wasn't the top of his priority list. And as much as Condi tried to make efforts to ameliorate the bureaucracy, it was clear that she wound up adopting a similar strategy.
That's right. You know, she does. It is interesting that some of her top aides are career Foreign Service people. If you look at someone like David Welch, who's the top Middle East advisor, or Christopher Hill, who's the chief North Korean negotiator, they are career Foreign Service. It's not like she's, you know, not relied on that expertise, but she does rely on a very small, closed circle. She doesn't like leaks. She doesn't like to distribute information. And so a lot of the building feels really cut off from what she's doing, which is particularly in contrast to Colin Powell, who, essentially was beloved in the State Department, and people felt that he really drew ideas from the bottom. Now,
but of course, the contrast to that is that if you compare their influence within the administration, Powell was almost emasculated as Secretary of State, whereas Condi, you know, is clearly seen as a much more powerful figure.
Right, and it's an interesting management conundrum.
Yeah.
You're managing a large organization. I mean, it's about 50,000 plus people,
right,
if you include the Foreign Service nationals at State. There's no way you're going to be on top of everything those people are doing. At the same time, you have to work your relationship with the president and present new and interesting ideas, be prepared for the interagency debates. Powell was, by the end of the administration, was largely cut out of that, because Cheney undercut him, Rumsfeld undercut him, Rice was not much of a facilitator to get his ideas over there. And did he benefit at all from having those ideas bubble up from the State Department? And it's kind of when in a large bureaucracy like that, ideas get kind of,
smoothed out.
Exactly. And in fact, Rice, when she became Secretary of State, she brought in Phil Zelikow to be her counselor. And his idea was going to be her in-house think. His role was to be the in-house think tank at her side, which meant she didn't have to rely on the State Department bureaucracy. But at the same time, what I've been told about Baker's style, which I think is different than Rice's style, Baker, though he relied on a small group of people, knew where to get information if he needed it. It's unclear if Rice knows where to get that information. And certainly you have a bunch of examples, which I had detailed in a recent article, a bunch of examples of where she didn't find out about bad news until it was too late.
Right. I mean, I blogged about this also because I remember that article where, you do have to wonder. Part of the reason you're correct. I think she clearly does ape Baker's style. And I think Baker's style, I remember this, also generated some, minor grumbling from FSOs, but the Foreign Service officers. But it didn't matter that much because, in the end, you judge Baker by the outcomes, which seemed to be relatively successful. One has to wonder if part of the reason that you're getting grumblings from FSOs at this point is because she pursued this style, which is going to turn them off, but also because her foreign policy record the outcomes don't, you know, which as you chronicle in the book, don't look terribly successful. So, I mean, partly it's outcome-based, wouldn't you say?
Right, right. I mean, you know, anyone at the State Department would want to have a Secretary of State with clout.
Yeah.
And Rice's, you know, ace in the hole is the fact that she's very close to the president. I mean, as I write in the book, he describes her to foreign leaders as my sister, which, you know, was pretty powerful stuff.
Well, Condi also, you know, once I was surprised, you never mentioned this in the book, where Condi absentmindedly mistakenly called Bush her husband.
Yeah, actually, what she said was my hub.
Ah, right, and she's
and it cut her off. It was at a cocktail party,
yeah.
And I wasn't sure how much. That is a huge deal has been made of that. I chose not to make that much of a deal out of it, in part because I thought it was kind of an old anecdote. But it was my hub.
Yeah.
Not my hub, and then she, you know, and who knows how many drinks people had at that. It was at the home, I think, of the bureau chief of the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times.
Ah, okay. Well, that's another reason I can see why you wouldn't have mentioned it.
No, that wasn't weird.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, stray offhand comments like that are a bit of a problem. But I assume you're getting obviously some interesting dirt, I assume, from the FSOs, in part because they're disgruntled at both Rice's management style and at the outcomes that are taking place.
Yes, no, I've gotten a phenomenal number of cables. You know, I've detailed lately, you know, problems with the construction and the Iraq embassy,
right,
and what have you. And there was one State Department official who was jokingly saying that they should just probably on the cables at the bottom just put CC Washington Post, since so many of them were being leaked out.
That's great for you. I'm sure a little more somewhat problematic for State. One of the details in one of the articles, and you mentioned this in the book as well, that was a little bit surprising, is that Condi does not read any email.
That's right. Right. She doesn't. I mean, they will print out, I guess, some emails for her, but she doesn't like to communicate in email.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it has to do with, and some of her aides are like this too, I think part of it has to do with a fear of those are written records.
Right. They can be subpoenaed.
Well, they can be subpoenaed, and there's a paper trail and whatever. She really prefers face-to-face communication.
This has been an interesting hallmark of Rice since she got into the bureaucracy, which is one thing I think she does share with Bush, is this absolute, you know, drive to keep things secret and to not declassify and to keep as much of a close hold on information as possible. I knew there were issues when she got to NSC, and I think also at State, about when, you know, various kinds of documents could be declassified. And the administration has basically been on, you know, pursued a very consistent course of action, which is anything they can classify, they will classify.
Right, right, right. And she is really, and this is one of the things she will say to aides, is, you know, top aides, is don't brief down. I mean, people at State will be asked to send out cables and not understanding what's the purpose of those cables, because the information is kept so close hold because she doesn't want to, you know, reveal her hand.
Hmm. Well, I mean, again, that's a gentle criticism, I would say, of the book. We talked about this a little bit before, was, I mean, the book focuses on Rice, and, I mean, it's fascinating. But one of the things I kept wondering was, to what extent was Rice boxed in terms of the courses of action she could pursue by Cheney and Rumsfeld? I mean, you allude to the point that, you know, their influence waned over the course of the second term. But I guess, you know, they still exerted a relatively powerful, you know, constraint, and even, you know, within the State Department, John Bolton was clearly more allied with, at least his points of view, with people like Rumsfeld and Cheney than with Rice, and that also proved to be, you know, a bit of a roadblock for Condi to pursue the policy she wanted to pursue.
Right. The book focuses on Rice. It's not intended to be a full history of all the interagency battles and debates, but you know, what you saw in the second term when she moved over to Secretary of State is, Rumsfeld was increasingly preoccupied with the Iraq War. Now, I do have a chapter in there where I talk about this trip that Rumsfeld and Rice took, where they got along very, very poorly.
Yeah, it was a good read.
Thank you. And Cheney, again, he began to step us away from a number of issues. I mean, I think the issue that Cheney is still very terribly concerned about is the Iranian issue, and it has been a bit of a break there on Rice. But you look at something like North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
That policy changed almost 180 degrees after Rumsfeld was fired by the president. Cheney has not been much of a player on that particular issue, and suddenly Rice is moving in a very, very different direction. I don't think Cheney is much of a factor in that debate anymore. I mean, I recount how in January of this year, when Chris Hill went to Berlin to meet with his North Korean counterpart, Rice flew into Berlin, saw the deal he was tentatively struck, picked up the phone, called the president, said, "Mr. President, this is a very good deal. You should, I've faxed over a copy of it. Steve Hadley will take you through it, and I think you should agree to this." And he did. And it, and that's when you saw a number of people like Bob Joseph, who was the arms control chief. He quit in anger and disgust over that. John Bolton by then had already left, and he was immediately
furious. I mean, he was launching attack after attack when that occurred.
Right. If you wanted a quote, he was happy to oblige.
To what extent would you say? Again, I know you're mostly State Department, but I'm curious about Cheney. Do you think this is a situation where his power was weakened so that he felt he should only focus on a few issues? Do you actually think he learned? Was there any kind of learning from, the mistakes made in the first term? I mean, this is the $64,000 question, which is what goes on in the mind of Dick Cheney. But, I guess I'm wondering, is his influence limited by circumstances or by an actual recognition that maybe past policies haven't worked terribly well?
Well, I don't know about, I'm not going to try to guess, Dick Cheney's sense of recognition. I mean, and I have to say, I once took a trip with him out to Asia, spent a week with him, and it was really quite interesting because he's a very, very smart guy, very knowledgeable, and extremely knowledgeable about issues. I mean, he's the ultimate policy wonk, and you don't necessarily see that in many of his interviews. And he gets a bit of a reputation as the Darth Vader of the administration, which I think to some extent is an exaggeration. I mean, here are the circumstances. One is, I think it's difficult to underestimate the impact of Scooter Libby, his chief aide, having to leave the administration, because Scooter really kept his fingers on what was going on and was, I think, a very unknown, powerful force in the administration on foreign policy issues. The people that replaced Scooter just were not up to doing that in the way that Scooter could.
Well,
in fact,
David
they
Addington
divided
replaced
the,
him, didn't he? Or what? Didn't David Addington replace him?
Well, they kind of divided the job.
Oh, I
mean, Scooter was both the chief of staff and the chief foreign policy advisor.
Addington became chief of staff, and then who became the foreign policy?
John Hannah.
I see. Okay.
So he became the foreign policy, but it wasn't quite. Libby actually had principal status.
Yeah.
So, which was unusual unto itself. He was not.
Well, wait a minute.
Deputy.
To be fair, I think Leon Firth, who was Gore's, foreign policy guru, also had that status.
He had principal status. Okay, then I stand corrected.
Yeah, I think he had, because Firth was unique. I think he actually managed to have principal status and deputy status, which gave him kind of unique leverage at that point.
Right. Though, of course, Gore has had certain foreign policy tracks he focused on.
Right.
Was Cheney could focus on anything that struck
him. No, there's definitely, I completely agree with. You're right.
And you do see within the second term, you have, the State Department was completely neutered under Powell, and you had the combination, the 1-2 punch of Rumsfeld and Cheney. So now in the second term, there's the Secretary of State, which is Rice, who's very close to the president in a way that Powell never could dream of. And you had Cheney losing Scooter relatively soon in the second term, at the 11th month of the second term. And it could well be that you also saw the president thinking, I got a few years left. These old approaches aren't working. Condi is pressing me to do this, start to talk to the Iranians, or at least offer to talk to the Iranians. Condi is pressing me, try this. And he's more open to those ideas. I mean, the president is still very stubborn. It's still his administration. But I think the combination of those factors reduced impact of Cheney on those interagency debates, except for Iran, which I think I view as is still very much an issue that he's focused on.
Yeah, that officially scares the crap out of me, though. But because I'm not sure, I blog about this. The last, you know, one of the concerns you always have when you read about the administration is this feeling like they don't want to leave problems to the next administration, that they want to solve them, you know, before January 20, 2009. So I'm not sure how you solve Iran between now and January 20 in a way that does not involve large amounts of bombs, and I don't think that's a real solution. But this is obviously a source of concern. One of the other issues, I actually think it was interesting. I don't know if you saw the speech that Bob Gates, you know, who's Rumsfeld's successor, gave earlier this week. And this I found extraordinary, where Gates actually winds up calling for increased resources, not for his own department, where, you know, Gates says we need more soft power resources. You know, we need more ability to engage in you know, the civilian side of state building, which is rather extraordinary for a defense secretary to be saying. I mean, I think it makes some sense. But I was wondering, I mean, this ties into some I think, tensions that you've talked about more recently about the ability of state to provide civilian officials for these kinds of postings.
Right. Well, they've had trouble. I mean,
yeah.
And this was you know, in part of this kind of Foreign Service revolt against Rice and her management of the State Department when she was forced to basically say, I'm going to order people to Iraq if I can't fill these jobs. Now, ultimately, they did, but one of the complaints of the State Department officials is that they're being sent to Iraq and they don't have any real training, which is a different situation, as I understand it, than Vietnam. You were sent to Vietnam. I think there were directed assignments there, but there was far more training than what State Department people get now.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Gates is a far cry from Rumsfeld, who wanted to hoard as much power at the Pentagon and was, you know, refusing to even cooperate on intelligence sharing and other things like that, trying to set up his own intelligence shop. You know, the idea that Rumsfeld would be giving a speech where he'd be saying there needs to be more for state to do,
mm-hmm.
Is rather extraordinary. In fact, you know, a lot of people will say that the real problems with the war in Iraq began when the president signed the directive giving the Defense Department control of, you know, Iraqi nation building after the war.
Well, no, I mean, this is testimony. I mean, Gates actually thinks that state building is possible, apparently, and that defense doesn't have the monopoly of intelligence on that, whereas Rumsfeld, I think, attitude was, we don't want to give state that job, because that's a decline in influence in the Defense Department, but we don't want to do it either because our job is warfight.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it worked so well.
Yes. I mean, this is one of the, you know, you pointed out that one of the mysteries of Condi is that she actually maintains personal popularity despite her role to some extent in the run-up to the Iraq War. I'm wondering if that's changed a little bit, at least since Rumsfeld left, in part because it's left her as sort of the most principal target associated with the first term.
That's true, but I haven't really noticed that in the polling. I've had to keep track of that. And the poll that I cite in the book had, you know, basically 50% of Americans saying she had little or no role in the invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty amazing, considering she was on TV saying, you know, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. The fact that she was a national security advisor and so close to the president. And I attribute, and it could be that people, they know it was Rumsfeld and they kind of think she was a kind of a weak national security advisor.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that's an indictment of her, and ironically, I would say.
Right. But on the other hand, I don't know if, you know, when you do that kind of overall polling of Americans, are they really thinking in those terms? Mm-hmm. But I also attributed it to the very slick efforts on the part of Rice and her staff to erase the images of her as a weak national security advisor and give the image of her as a very powerful Secretary of State who might even have presidential aspirations.
Hmm.
And I kind of detail that in the book about the various things they did, such as...
She was never photographed alone, or a lot of the photo ops, she was always with someone, I think you said.
Right. That, and then that was the counter to the idea of her being cold and unfriendly. Yeah. They had these very nice things like walking in front of Indian temples or being an ice skating rink with Chinese Olympic aspirants. And the reason for that was... the idea was that those pictures would be irresistible for the morning TV shows. You know, they wouldn't run pictures of a bunch of you know, people standing in front of podiums. But those pictures would get on the morning TV shows, and people, while they're fixing their coffee and glancing back, they'd see Condi Rice there on the road and be thinking, oh, there's my Secretary of State doing diplomacy. Not war making, doing diplomacy, dealing with, you know, exposure to international cultures.
Well, this highlights, I mean, again, I think another contrast between Rice and Powell, which you talk about a little bit in the book, but again, I think is more favorable to Rice, which is she actually traveled, even though she didn't like to travel. I mean, Powell was, I think, the least traveled Secretary of State over the previous, you know, three decades or something like that.
That's right. That's actually an article I wrote at the end of Powell's term, which he never quite forgave me for.
But it's true. What was his response? I'm curious.
Well, his initial response was, he just got very angry at that piece because it all became part of the...
His legacy.
It became part of the conventional wisdom of Colin Powell. Yeah. But it was, in fact, truth. And even people at the White House couldn't understand why he didn't want to travel. Part of it was that he felt if he left town, Cheney and Rumsfeld would create more mischief.
Right.
Maybe he didn't have that confidence that he could be around. But he also just didn't like to do it. And Rice doesn't like to do it either, but she understands that, particularly in this age of emails and global communication, it still is useful to sit down. And if she flies to Saudi Arabia, she will have a 2-3 hour meeting with the King of Saudi Arabia, just the two of them. Mm-hmm. You know, that presumably should pay off for the United States.
No, it's true, and you know, you can argue that she. And I mean, this gets to an interesting question about Rice's legacy, which is there's no question. I think, I mean, I would assume you would agree with this, that she's repaired a fair amount of the damage that took place between Washington, let's say, and Europe in the run-up to the Iraq War. I mean, the transatlantic relationship now is on much stronger terms at the elite level, I would say, than it was in 2003. And similarly, you know, with other countries, I mean, let's accept the Middle East for a second. I think she's pulled some initiatives that have probably improved the U.S. standing, again, among elites. But as you point out, and there's no denying this, the popular perception is, you know, increasing anti-Americanism. That's probably tied to Iraq much more than Rice. But this raises an interesting question of just what are the fundamental limits on a Secretary of State? In other words, you know, even if you travel and if you repair the relationship at the elite level, do you think these popular pressures towards anti-Americanism are going to pose fundamental constraints on U.S. foreign policy going out?
Well, they are, and I mean, it's a challenge that the next president will face, and the next Secretary of State. It's not just going to end with, you know, George Bush's departure from the scene. Mm-hmm. Some of this is endemic, mm-hmm. or has become endemic. You know, and Rice, to her credit, she did bring in, she did try to elevate the idea of public diplomacy. She brought in Karen Hughes, who. Was not great.
No, that was not
overseas.
One of her Hughes's best moments.
Well, yes, but actually, to defend Karen Hughes a little bit, mm-hmm. Karen Hughes was, I was on her first trip to the Middle East. It was a disaster.
Right, that's the one that's widely recognized as being a disaster.
Right, yeah. And she realized that, and she didn't really travel much after that. What she did concentrate it on was using her clout as one of the best friends of the president to force real changes in how public diplomacy is done and delivered. And those things presumably will last. For instance, they created a 24-hour rapid response unit. There's a whole group of people that sit in a room and they watch every Arab channel. They look at all the Arab papers. And by the time everyone comes into the office at 6 in the morning, there's a sheet there, a guide that says, here's what's making news. Here's how we should respond to it. So you can see, actually, the State Department will respond much more quickly to something like that Republican presidential candidate saying we should nuke Mecca and Medina. You know, within hours of that being on the news in the Arab world, the State Department spokesman denounced it, said it was ridiculous, and the story died. Hmm. It used to be that before Karen Hughes got on the scene, that story would erupt and you'd have mass riots throughout the Islamic world before the State Department realized what was going on.
This is one of these things where you begin to wonder if, I mean, it's almost unfair for the State Department because they not only have to explain official U.S. policy, but increasingly, I mean, this is one of the effects of globalization, I think, is that increasingly they not only have to explain official U.S. policy, they have to explain factions, you know, actions by non-official individuals, as you know, the debate or other instances where the problem is the perception overseas is that that represents, you know, official U.S. policy or essentially represents official U.S. policy.
Well, it was on that trip that Hughes made on her first trip to the Middle East, she was really surprised when she went to see Turkish officials that all they wanted to talk to her about was an op-ed column by a conservative writer that appeared in the Washington Times.
Huh.
And she kept trying to say to them, we have nothing to do with that. That guy doesn't work for us. You know, it's unrelated. But they were obsessed with it.
Huh.
And she was kind of, and then the same thing when she went to Saudi Arabia, there were lots of complaints about something that was said on Oprah about Saudi women.
Seriously?
Yes. And she was trying to say, we don't have anything to do about that.
Yeah.
But it, she really came away with the sense that, you know, it's out of the U.S. government's control, but it has to deal with it anyway.
But you still have to deal with the response. No, I remember,
right.
I mean, there was another example where Iran got very upset by the release of the movie 300, where they were convinced that this was actually a plot by the U.S. government, you know, to portray the Persians as you know, evil and all power, you know, and all conquering.
Right. Well, you have to remember also in those societies, you know, their government control is pretty strong, and things don't happen without the government having a hand in it. And so it's difficult for them to understand that even though we go on and on about the great freedoms in the United States, that there's no hidden conspiracy by the Bush administration to actually have these things happen.
Yeah. No, so that's probably a useful intervention by Karen Hughes. That's a fair point. Going back to the book, another theme that I think ran through it, which I found interesting, was the notion that one of the things that hamstrung Rice and a lot of her top officials is that almost all was ironically past success. That all of them had experiences working, you know, sort of in the at lower levels in the first Bush administration, Bush 41, and that they had, you know, they had witnessed the fall of the Soviet Union and the transformation of Eastern Europe. And as a result, you know, that they carried this over in their beliefs about how to deal with the Middle East. I mean, would you say that's a safe assessment?
Yes. No, it's that's exactly right. And you know, in, Rice is a very religious person. She doesn't really wear it on her sleeve, but she does feel that there's kind of a plan that God has laid out for her that has unfolded. And you know, when she first went to Washington and was there for the fall of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the reunification of Germany, and she thought, you know, I'll never be again in a such a turn in history. And then she finds herself, you know, at the turn of history of 9/11, back in Washington, working for the son of the president she used to work for,
right.
And that had a real profound effect on her.
Mm.
And you know, what you see a lot of is, you know, Rice and Zelikow and others trying to recreate that success that they had with, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union. And you know, one of those things that Rice is trying to push right now on the North Korean issue is kind of recreating the game plan that was used for the reunification of Germany and apply it to Asia, which most Asian specialists would say doesn't make much sense.
No, it is apples and oranges.
And then the same thing with the Middle East, the idea that the Soviet Union collapsed in part because of a flowering of democracy brought along by the Helsinki Accords and the pressures that brought on. And you just apply that to the Middle East and, you know, democracy will flow and it'll all work out. Now, as we know, looking at the victory of Hamas and the Palestinian legislative elections, the Middle East works in different ways.
Well, I think the biggest problem, I mean, if you take a look at it, the thing that distinguishes the Middle East, or at least, you know, what the effects of the policy has been, that you've got parties in the Middle East that are perfectly willing to pursue dual tracks. They're happy to participate in an electoral process if it takes place, but that doesn't mean they're going to relinquish extra legal means to try to exert their influence. I mean, you've seen this in Iraq, you've seen this in Lebanon, and you've seen it in the occupied territories.
Right. No, it's and one of the criticisms I have is that Rice never really seemed to have a game plan for how you're going to deal with those realities in the Middle East. And you know, and the president, too, it was kind of like, well, you know, if there's an election, then people aren't going to focus on Islamic jihadism. They're going to focus on essential services. Now, the irony is, in the case of Hamas, that's what happened.
That's what they do, yeah. I guess there's a larger question, which I would guess I would ask you, having covered the State Department, which is, to what extent, you know, are all of it, this isn't just a problem with Rice and her staff, I imagine this is going to extend to whoever takes over in 2009. To what extent do foreign policymakers suffer from the constraint of only assuming that what they want to do is replicate their own past successes? I mean, it's not just, you know, not just Rice. I mean, you talked about how Chris Hill in the book kept, you know, sort of trying to replicate what happened in Bosnia and the Balkans to North Korea. I mean, do they all think strictly in terms of analogies, or do they have any sort of, you know, recognition of, well, the analogy might not hold?
You know, it's a very tempting thing for human beings to do.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to begrudge people for thinking that, you know, what worked for me in the past might work to me again.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, you know, coming to the point where you recognize that that's not going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
I look back. I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, if it works for you once, you might try it again. But it's going to be, part of the interesting thing is, you know, one of the criticisms of this administration is that they were very unprepared for the war on terrorism, because they had missed that. They were out of office for 8 years,
right,
and they'd kind of missed that. They weren't able to internalize it. They came in, and you look back at what they were focused on. They were focused on
China,
missile shield,
yeah,
and China. You know, and these were things that they were obsessed with 8 years earlier,
mm-hmm,
which is kind of interesting if you think, here are foreign policy experts, and they were not noticing what was going on for 8 years.
Well, I think part of the problem is, in some ways, 9/11 was perfectly timed from the point of view of trying to exacerbate the Bush administration's mistakes. Because if you go back to the Clinton administration, their first 6 months in office in terms of foreign policy was essentially a disaster. They had no idea what to do, and it was the same problem of, they were, you know, influenced by past experience. You also had Carter administration officials coming in and thinking, we're going to make human rights the main issue, you know, on a whole variety of things, including China. I mean, as you said, one of the things that impressed you about Rice in your first meeting was the fact that she was criticizing Clinton for thinking that you had to, you know, push human rights on China when that wasn't going to work in terms of realpolitik terms.
Right.
The difference might be is that in the Clinton administration, they screwed up, but the foreign policy environment was so benign that they could make those mistakes, not suffer tremendous hits for them in terms of loss of American power, and then, you know, they moved down the learning curve as they went forward. I have to wonder, a part of the problem with the Bush administration is they made the exact same mistakes in terms of trying to apply past lessons and realizing it wasn't going to work. And then just around the time they might have actually moved down the learning curve, 9/11 happens, which causes them to make a whole additional series of mistakes.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting analysis. I mean, I think, you know, and it's unclear how far down the learning curve this administration has gotten.
No, I think, and particularly George W. Bush, I don't think has moved that far at all down the learning curve. And that's been the fascinating thing. I was working in the I worked for the Treasury Department for a year, from 2000 to 2001, just as a staff person. And the amazing thing during those first 6 months was there was massive frustration as new people came in. You know, Paul O'Neill, you know, would come in and didn't understand anything that was going on in terms of various kinds of policy initiatives. But the generous assumption was, okay, he's got to learn the ropes. After about 6 months, he'll figure it out. And the amazing thing about so many of the Bush officials was they never learned.
Mm-hmm.
There was massive suspicion of the staff bureaucracy, you know, convinced that they were all mostly Democrats, which, to be fair, a large percentage of them are. But it was also the perception that if Clinton had favored anything, they therefore should oppose it. You know, failing to realize the general principle that 90% of what the U.S. government does in terms of policy, they're doing it for a reason, and probably it's not going to change from administration to administration.
Right. Well, that was you know, part of the very in terms of foreign policy, certainly one of the striking things about the transition from Clinton to Bush is that there was such dramatic shifts,
right,
such a rejection of previous policies, which I don't think he necessarily had going from Bush to Clinton. the first President Bush.
No, I mean, there was, again, I think there were, it wasn't nearly as nasty of a transition as my understanding.
I don't know if you ever heard one of the jokes about Clinton's Bosnia policy, which was, what's the difference between Bush's Bosnia policy and Clinton's Bosnia policy?
I don't know.
There's no difference except Clinton feels bad about it.
that's a good one. I like that. No, I mean, this transition was a little more hostile. And you're right. I mean, they rejected a lot of the advice. Going on to, you know, what's happened since the book came out, you know, Rice has continued to push on the Middle East, and we just had the Annapolis Peace Conference last week. And I have to say, having read your book, I'm now incredibly pessimistic about anything happening. Not that I was terribly optimistic before, but this points to, again, one of your themes in the book is the tendency for a lack of follow-through. That even when the administration, they always talk a good game, and they'll often come up with these sort of big grand meetings, as you know, designed not just for the photo op, but for this sort of gesture of jump-starting talks. And then, you know, Rice, and I think to a larger extent Bush also, just completely whiff in terms of follow-through or implementation.
Right, and we really run the risk of that with the Annapolis conference. Mm-hmm. It was an achievement for this administration to get all those Arab countries there, to sit there at the moment that the Israelis and the Palestinians announced they're going to take, for the first time in 7 years, serious talks and trying to get a final settlement. But what next?
Right.
You know, if you go back and look at the Madrid conference of 1991, there was Arab participation there, and there actually were working groups set up to kind of get some more Arab buy-in. Now, it didn't, in the end, necessarily amount to much, but at least there was an effort on Baker's part to keep the Arabs engaged. And what you see here, it's unclear what the follow-up is going to be. Now, again, you know, I've said Rice keeps the cards close to her vest, but so there may well be a plan, but if there is one, it's not apparent yet.
Well, I mean, there are mixed signals as you look going past. On the one hand, it's clear that Connie has devoted a fair amount of personal effort on this issue. I mean, this is the one area where she's really engaged in shuttle diplomacy. She's trying to talk to all the parties involved. You know, she was clearly engaged in personal intervention. So that would seem to think that she's got, you know, she's invested in trying to get a useful result. On the other hand, you had these disturbing stories, some of which you wrote. You know, I mean, even a week prior to the conference, no one was sure when the exact date was. No one had yet figured out who the participants were. The agenda wasn't laid out. I mean, you almost had the sense, as a professor, you almost had the sense of students suddenly realizing, oh, God, the paper's due in a week. What are we going to do? I mean, was this unusual by Condi's standards, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, State Department people will say that they were, they had a idea of a date in hand, and everyone kind of knew what it was, but they didn't want to announce it because, you know, it kept everyone focused. But I spoke to an awful lot of Arab diplomats that just felt like it was being made up on the fly.
Right.
And they weren't being brought into the process. They did show up. It's unclear what they're going to do now, if they really have much buy-in for this process. It's unclear what the U.S. role is going to be as we go forward. It seems pretty clear that President Bush doesn't want to do the same kind of thing that Clinton or Carter did, where he's there, you know, at Camp David trying to knock heads and force these guys to reach an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, the other thing is that the unreality of Annapolis was that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, is only in charge of half of the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
And Hamas is in charge of Gaza. So would the Israelis really make a deal with a guy that can only deliver half the Palestinians? It was a huge elephant in the room that was never really mentioned. And you know that the Egyptians and the Saudis, while they were there in the audience, are behind the scenes trying to get the Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas back together
right.
again. And as soon as Abbas does that, Omar will say, well, you're dealing with terrorists. Right. I'm not going to deal with you.
One of the suggestions or the spin that's been coming out since Annapolis is that one of the reasons why most of the Arab governments were willing to participate had less to do with the Israel-Palestinian issue and much more to do with Iran. Which is that maybe one of the successes was they might be able to peel the Syrians away from its close relationship with Iran, and the concerns about a rising Iran are causing the Arab governments to realize, you know, they need to participate in this process. I mean, do you think that's true, or do you think it's exaggerated?
Well, and there's an element of that. certainly this whole process started, the Arab-Israeli track, after Rice got really worried and concerned about Iranian involvement in the wake of the war in Lebanon.
Right.
Now, whether or not, I mean, you know, none of the Arabs really buy this language that Rice uses of extremist states versus moderate, extremist forces versus moderate forces in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I mean, as one Arab diplomat said to me, you know, the alliances shift like the sands in the Arab world. So right now, yes, there's concern about Iran. Right now, it makes sense to kind of try to, you know, everyone in the Arab world would like the Arab-Israeli situation, the Israeli-Palestinian situation resolved in order to lessen that problem in their streets. But is that what is really what is driving these countries here? It may be a stretch at this point to say that that's the main issue.
Okay. I mean, going forward, I was reading in the papers today that Olmert has already said that he doesn't see the 2008 deadline as an actual deadline. Do you think that this process, you know, is more likely to disintegrate along with previous efforts to try to jumpstart the process, or is the fact that Condi has clearly devoted a lot of personal capital to this? Plus, you have to wonder. I mean, you might know this better than I do. I have to assume that she recognizes the disaster that her birth pangs comment has sort of left in terms of the perceptions of the United States and the Middle East. I mean, is this a sense that she wants to rectify that mistake?
Right. Well, she's never said that again. It was a comment that just reverberated very badly in the region.
Right.
It's too soon to figure out exactly what Annapolis is going to lead to. I mean, you know, and sometimes just the fact that you get everyone in the room and you begin a process, it may develop in ways that the administration doesn't even begin to imagine. Rice is very much this believer in the idea of setting up structures. And like I said, it was an important moment in her life when she felt that she had, when the Soviet Union collapsed, that she was able to benefit from the structures set up decades earlier
right.
by Dean Acheson and George Marshall. I think her hope is that, you know, one day some future Secretary of State will look back and say, you know, I was able to achieve Israeli-Palestinian peace, and I was able to achieve it because of, you know, it all started in Annapolis because of Condoleezza Rice. I think that's what she really hopes for. The notion that this deal was going to be struck in the next year is quite a stretch.
This is it leads to an interesting grand irony. As you point out, I mean, she says this in the book, she recognizes the legacy that Marshall and Truman and others, you know, in setting up various Cold War structures made her job much easier during the end of the Cold War. And yet this administration has been relatively disdainful of sort of explicit institutional, you know, multilateral institutions, and has actually been relatively reluctant to create new ones. I mean, some of the ones that she's, they've created some new ones, but they've all been much more informal. And this was the topic of, I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs back in the spring about the recognition by Rice and others that, you know, we're in a sort of newer distribution of power, that rising powers like China and India need to be brought into the game a little bit better. I mean, do you think that to some extent that effort will have some momentum going forward?
The effort to create structures?
Yeah.
Well, they only have a year left,
yeah.
but you can see it. She wants to do it in the Middle East, so some sort of Annapolis, post-Annapolis structure. She wants to do it on the Korean Peninsula. Some sort of peace regime, you know, leads to final armistice talks and a peace agreement. She is definitely looking for that as some sort of as a legacy that historians could point to. But whether she's able to achieve it in the next 14 months is really unclear. I mean, they're really running out of time and I think for a lot of governments right now, they're making a bet. They're trying to decide, do I do this with these guys now?
Or do they do it with whoever's going to take over in 2009?
Right. I mean, you can almost hear the calculations in the North Korean leader's mind, Kim Jong-il, that, you know, if I get a deal with, you know, he got a deal with Clinton, and the next president came in and rejected Bush. But if he gets a deal with Bush, who's supposed to be this, you know, hardline conservative who loathes the North Korean leader, maybe that will have more staying power. Hmm. Would a Democrat really be able to then roll it back and say, I don't agree with this? So that's a very interesting calculation, and it may work to Bush's and Rice's advantage. Hmm.
This leads to an interesting question, which is what's going to happen to Condi after 2009? You speculate in the book that she would actually that she's considering or that might consider running for office in California. Do you still think that's true?
Yes, it's entirely. I mean, I don't think she's given much thought to her future one way or the other. I mean, that was what some of her aides had suggested to me. It was a possibility, and I think she has had an interest in electoral politics before. She considered running for Congress at one point. And she always says she prefers a strong executive position. I don't see it as an immediate thing that she would do. I think she wants to go back to Stanford, where she probably will not get a great reception.
No, there was a New York Times story, I remember, a couple months ago about how there was already protests about her going to Hoover and so forth.
Yeah, well, it was funny. When I was having lunch with someone at Stanford who is friendly with Rice, when I was researching this book, you know, the maitre d' of the restaurant we went to, the faculty club, mm-hmm. said, you realize, of course, they're building a gallows on the front lawn for your friend. That was a year and a half ago. So, you know, but on the other hand, I think she probably wants to make some money. Mm. You know, there's, you know, Don Regan once famously said, you know, before you take any job, make sure you have some, I don't know if you can use the word.
It's fuck you money. I'll say it.
Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah. And you need that. So, and she could make a lot of money very quickly giving speeches, mm-hmm. serving on corporate boards, she talks about sports management. She could do what President Bush did, which is get a bunch of very rich people to buy her a sports team. She gets a big slice of the equity, mm-hmm. and she manages that team, a football team. She's a very young person.
Right, she's only 52 at this point, right?
Right, you know, just about to turn, or just turned 53, I think.
Okay.
She has a good two decades of pretty active life ahead of her, mm-hmm. and so she could go in a completely different direction, or maybe she'll write a book. She jokes that she'd only write a book that no one would want to read, you know, a very academic treaties, but
I'm a political scientist, so that's the kind of book I actually do want to read, but I would understand if the rest of the readers might not be as interested in that.
Yeah, but you know, if Random House or Simon & Schuster come around waving a check for $1.5 million for her tell-all memoirs, maybe tempting to pass that up.
I have to say, I'm very skeptical about whether or not she's going to run for political office. You know, this was the one thing I got from my personal interactions with her. I mean, she's incredibly charming and you know, very good one-to-one, but you always got the sense, or I always got the sense whenever I talked to her about politics, that it was not something she wanted to do in terms of seeking elective office. That she's always been, as you point out, an executive branch person. And now maybe that would mean being governor of California would have its mm-hmm. appeals, but I mean, this runs into the second problem, which is, what do you think Rice's legacy will be in terms of the attitudes about her tenure? I mean, you know, to some extent, your book is really the first one to focus on her. You know, and I don't think there's any way you can come away from reading this book without having a sense of tragedy. I mean, I think the most ironic sequence is where you've got in the last chapter where she's actually asking the State Department historian to review what the Clinton administration did on the peace processes in the late 90s, which is, again, the thing that they had rejected when they came into office.
Right, right. Well, her hope, of course, is that just like Dean Acheson and Harry Truman were viewed so negatively at the time, that the wheel will turn and people will have a much better view decades later. But, you know, that in terms of immediate legacy, it may be difficult. I mean, and that's why she may go in a completely different direction and just say, you know, to hell with policy and foreign policy, I'm going to, you know, focus on football.
She is a big football fan, no question about that.
Yes, she's fanatical.
Yes.
Believe me, I don't know much about football, and I'm always confused when she uses those analogies on the road.
Ah, see, Glenn, this would improve your reportorial skills. You've got to actually, you know, if you show a greater interest in football, maybe you get better quotes from her. I want to close with one question. This goes back to this soft power question, and it's something that you talked about a little bit in the book, which was, you know, Rice as a black woman from the South, you know, making sort of an interesting effect on how, you know, she was perceived in foreign capitals, that in some cases this was a positive perception, and in other cases, particularly Sergei Lavrov from Russia, that this had its own problems. This connects to an interesting question that Barack Obama has been making as he's been running for president, and a lot of others have argued that Barack Obama, you know, if he were elected, would do more to build, you know, American soft power. Andrew Sullivan's made this argument. Others have made this argument. Having followed Rice, do you think this is really true, or is it more a question of the policies that the government pursues?
Well, I mean, get back to the public diplomacy thing.
Yeah.
You know, even Karen Hughes would say, you know, 80% of it is the policies.
Right.
And all she was able to deal with was the other 20%. I mean, the policies are important, but, you know, I have to say that having been with Rice overseas, she is very effective in using her life story in a way to make a point. I mean, I have seen audiences literally gasp when she says, you know, on the original U.S. Constitution, I was just 3/5 of a person.
Right.
And that has a real impact on those audiences because there's a notion of humility, there's a notion of that, you know, the American Constitution wasn't perfect.
Right.
The idea that someone who was once considered 3/5 of a person could now have this very powerful position. So I think, you know, that's a great, you know, wonderful example of use of biography.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the case of both Democratic candidates, you know, there was a use of biography. You know, if the United States finally had a female president, I think they would have an impact around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Even though a lot of countries have had female presidents, and you have the Chancellor of Germany and so forth, that would have an impact. And or if you had a multiracial man become president with a name like Barack Obama, I mean that says wonders about the American democracy.
Although it does lead to an interesting irony, which is, I mean, we've actually had a string of Secretary of States now that have been, you know, not white men, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, Madeleine Albright, followed by Colin Powell, followed by Condi Rice. If you take a look at who the principal foreign policy advisors are to the leading candidates, though, I'm pretty sure the next Secretary of State is going to be a white man.
I know. But, you know, they could just... If someone had a sense of humor about it, you know, if Hillary Clinton named Richard Holbrooke as you know, her Secretary of State, she could say she was doing it for diversity.
That would be a good line. That would be very amusing. Yeah, you know, it's time for a change. We need, you know, that would be an interesting way of doing it. So if they use that line, Glenn, we've got, you know, videotape that you were the one who intentionally or not fed that to President Clinton.
All right.
Well, with that, thank you. Again, you know, the book is The Confidant. I'll show you this time. It was quite an interesting read. Go out and buy it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Glenn.
Sure, bye.
Bye.